Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Michael Dardon is hard to pin down when it comes to defining who he is. A magician, juggler, lecturer, actor, street performer, contest winner, comedian, mentor, master of ceremonies, or other. Yes, some of us wear many hats, but few are successful in all arenas as he is. Michael Dardon finished his nationwide lecture tour in Houston and sat down to discuss in detail some of the things he didn't have time to explain during some of the lectures. He tells some stories from the road, plus a funny story about working with Hollywood actor and director Sylvester Stallone on the set of a movie filmed in New Orleans. He also talks about the key elements of improvisational comedy, which every comedian and magician should learn. If you enjoyed his lecture when it came through your town, or if you haven't yet heard this multiple award-winning talent, then in either case, I know you will enjoy listening to Michael Dardon here on the MagicWordPodcast.com. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and I have with me as my guest tonight, Mr. Michael Dardon.
Bonjour. Merci.
You're welcome. De nada.
Yeah, there you go. It is Houston. I'm sorry.
That's right.
Gracias, señor. Yeah.
That's the way you go. Man, you're multilingual, or is that cunny?
Pretty much. Multi in that I can say, like, I would like a banana in several languages.
Yeah, because that's always something that you need to know, how to get a banana.
Yeah, or...
have you got a banana?
Or I can say I like apple juice. I can actually say that. That's one Spanish phrase.
Seriously?
Yo quiero jugo de manzana. See, that was perfect Spanish. I said I want apple juice.
And how often have you actually ordered apple juice? Do you drink apple juice?
I've actually ordered it accidentally because I've had waitresses and I said that and they brought me apple juice and they didn't know I was just kidding and I was just saying the one phrase I know. And so like, okay, I guess this guy wants apple juice. So sometimes it kind of backfires when you're trying to be funny.
It's like going to the TSA. You don't make any jokes, you know, when you're going through the line over there.
You don't know how they're going to take it.
Exactly. But you and I have chatted before several times on other podcasts, and for those of you, after you finished listening to this podcast, I'm sure that you might want to go back and to listen to some of those other podcasts. I regret that there was one that we recorded at Vectors a couple of years ago, and that was the one and only podcast that I recorded over the last several years.
You remember that, huh?
It died. It just completely did not record.
And I was so on.
You were. I mean, that would have been the best recording
perfection.
Ever. Oh, I have to.
Like, that was radio gold.
Quality.
I can't repeat. Yeah,
no,
we can
I'd
never
say platinum.
It's gone.
It's irretrievable. Yeah. You know, and it's like lightning in a bottle. We just can't put that back again.
No, it's out there somewhere.
But we'll try to recreate just in the ether somewhere to recreate at least some of the stuff that we talked about. There are so many things in different aspects of your life. You know, as I looked at your website, I was surprised with some of the acting background and some of the stuff that you have done. I mean, first of all, being a multi-award winner. How many, like 13 awards, or how many do you keep count now anymore?
I do when people say 13 when it's really more.
Okay. Sorry.
No, that was the right number for 2012. Yeah.
Wow.
So that was in 1 year.
You've done a lot of conventions, man.
I have. Well, okay. That year was a big year where I just kind of hit everything. And then after that, you know, I took a lot of flack from people when I went to like some of the smaller conventions after I had won the IBM close up.
And then you're going to just smaller regional conventions with less than 100 people or something.
And I didn't know. Like, to me, I was kind of new to the game. I didn't compete early on, so just was like, where's the competition? I want to go there. Okay, is there a prize money? Let's do it.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll pay for the trip. Mm-hmm. And then you win it, you're like, people are like, you already won the IBM. What are you doing here? And so I didn't know there was like...
What are you doing here?
Yeah.
You've been hanging around Sly Stallone too long.
That's what it is, yeah. what are you doing here? Yo, well, why are you doing this? You already won the big one. You know, get away from these little things. And so I didn't know there was, you know, kind of like a chain of command. And so the next year, I didn't go to as many. Actually, I only went to one. In 2000, well, we're in 14 now, 13... I did the
Camp.
Quebec. No, that was the year before.
Canadian.
In the Quebec, the Festival de Magie, which is a week-long festival in Quebec, which a lot of people I don't think know about.
Is that the one Ben Robinson puts on? Not Ben Robinson. Ben. Is that some who puts that on? Do you know?
The French Canadian guys.
Oh,
actually.
Good.
Well, there's a bunch of them that are. Okay. I'm not sure who actually is credited with like being in charge.
Mm-hmm.
But like about five different guys that I've been talking to. And I'm going back because I won two of the events last year. So that was my other two. So it's actually, it's 15 in 2 years is how I tell people. Like,
but when you win, are many of those prizes, or rather, do many of those prizes include an opportunity to come back and then they pay you as a performer the following year?
That's not always included as as part of the prize. Like the first time I remember it being part of the, like actually written out as part of the deal was IBM. When Sean Farquhar was in charge of booking the talent the following year, and he called me and he said, "Hey, handsome, guess what? Because you won the IBM last year, you get to come back as an honored guest and perform. Yay!" And so he made sure I was back.
Especially Sean came in for just a moment to recreate that moment.
Yeah, he just popped in just Thanks, to Sean, make hey. that statement. And so that was the IBM that it's definitely considered part of it, that if you win either stage or close-up, you're asked to come back as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that many – I don't remember it being part of like a contract on other winnings, but
did the TAOM do that? Because when you won the TAOM,
you know,
close up,
that was. I'm glad you brought that up. You brought that up, and I didn't because we're here in Houston, and I wasn't going to ask. But no, they never called.
Hmm.
I was sitting there waiting by the phone.
Yeah.
No, because I won the Magic Man Award,
right.
And I thought I remembered reading something that the winner would be asked to come back. But then I nobody called me the next year, and I would love to come back and perform. But actually, Quebec. Snag me because I'm going to be. I don't think it was part of their deal either that because I won or anything. Because actually, I didn't win the grand prize.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Trudeau, Canadian who did an unbelievable manipulation act, he won the grand prize in Quebec. So I'm sure he'll be. I'm assuming he'll be back. But I've been hired to come back and lecture and perform in Quebec. But it's the exact same weekend. It's Labor Day weekend.
Oh, that's
the Festival of the Magie that happens, and TAOM is always Labor Day weekend.
That's correct.
So it's going to have to be another year. But I don't know why they didn't call. Maybe they didn't think about it or what.
Well, I think that they used to do that on a regular basis, and then it got so that some of the people who were winners were outside the country, and they didn't want to necessarily pay for their long flights and whatnot, and plus it was up to really the following year's organizers,
sure.
And their budget of whether or not they wanted, you know, who they had in mind and what their goal was. You know, some people, like when I was president of the TAOM, that I had a direction, I had a focus, I had a vision of what I wanted the convention to be. It was specifically to be more business-minded. I've always said that we know enough tricks. It's a matter of just trying to do those more professionally and to find venues where you can perform them and to be better at what we have, you know,
sure.
And improve that. So I had a lot of business-oriented types of lectures to talk about. That kind of stuff. I don't remember that we had hired necessarily the winners from the previous year either. So I think that is at the discretion of the following year.
Well, that makes sense, actually. Mm-hmm. And looking at it, I thought about that in some cases, you may not want to have to commit to that. And mm-hmm. Just because somebody has won the competition, that might not be the particular act that you need for the show you're putting on. So you don't want to be kind of
good
like...
point.
Set in those standards of having to like, well, we have to have this act on because he won and it doesn't fit with the other acts or whatever's happening. So you kind of want to have a little more freedom than that. So that is a little bit strenuous if you're putting that clause in the contract.
Yeah, next year, the convention, the TAOM, this year is going to be in Fort Worth. Next year it's going to be in Austin, and Trixie Bond is going to be the president. And I know already that she has a vision of having women in magic.
Oh, cool.
And so she'll have various shows, close-up and stage, that will feature women. So unless that you have a sex change, I think that you're probably you're not going to...
Well, I do live in New Orleans. You never know. I mean, I'm not going to say that it can't happen because who knows what the future holds. I could easily pull it off. That's the thing. You know, they're so open-minded.
Yeah,
that
or put
no
it
one,
on.
No one... Yeah. No one would hold it against me, so to speak.
So, yeah.
But no, what I could do, though, is make sure that Kitty Chaos is ready to perform so you could book
There's
her. She's become my apprentice.
Tell me about her.
She's
and
like
about
my...
Your, what you mean doing for your stage act?
Well, she's like an assistant who's talented enough to work on her own. And there was one point when she was like, you know, I related to the cartoon where like it's Spike and his little friend, and his little friend just kind of, what are we doing? What are we doing? Spike, what are we doing? We're like, what's today? What's today? What's the, she was like, what do we got? What do we got? Are we performing this week? What do you got? And it was finally, I was like, look, you need to work on your own act. Get your act together, and you, if you want to perform that much, like, do a show, because like, I don't have anything for you this week.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm doing a show, but they're not paying me enough to hire an assistant. You know, I mean, unless you want to work for free, which she would, but she doesn't want to. None of us want to. So she did exactly that. She started, putting together her own act, and all of a sudden she's getting booked to MC and to perform in burlesque shows and, corporate events and all different types of variety entertainment as both a magician and an MC and
she does some comedy and everything as well.
And she does. We first started doing improv together, improv comedy, and
mainly stage, not close up.
Mainly, yeah, I'd say mainly stage. But she's actually, she understands the benefit of close up for sure, and is and knows that she's not going to win the respect of magicians unless she can be a good sleight of hand. She knows that she can't be invited to 4F unless she masters some sleight of hand.
Right.
And so she's working on everything. And I said, you know what? We're going to make sure competition ready. So watch out, because a woman magician is coming.
What's her name?
Kitty Chaos.
Kitty Chaos.
Mandy Turner is her real name, but Kitty Chaos is her stage name.
Like K-I-T-T-Y, Kitty, like a pussycat, like kitty cat, cat, yeah. Kitty cat, yeah.
Well, more like a strung out wet kitty that's had too much coffee.
Okay.
If you picture something like caffeine, that running around stage with all kind of energy, like a super ball bouncing around disguised as a kitten.
Like with a laser pointer and a cat.
If she had a laser pointer and she was soaked in water and had just had a Red Bull.
Okay.
That's Kitty Chaos.
Okay.
Gotcha. So now you have an image.
I do.
And in St. Louis, she's going to be there along with my other assistant, Trixie Minx, who is a whole nother story and a whole nother success story.
Yeah.
Totally different characters and unbelievable.
Have you mentored these ladies? Have you mentored them, or?
I have mentored Kitty because she wanted to learn magic, and she has absorbed everything she's like looked at. So, whether it's juggling or gymnastics or magic, she is capable of learning pretty much anything. And so now she's going to start working on competitions and would be a great addition to, you know, women in magic, anything with that theme.
Right.
Now Trixie has more mentored me in being open-minded about the fact that I don't have to do just kid shows, that I can be in a burlesque show as well and introduce women who are taking their clothes off.
Okay.
And so I've been mentored in that, because I didn't picture myself originally being in a burlesque show at all.
It's a lot different than kid shows. Yeah.
She's
kid
more,
shows to burlesque shows. Yeah. Over like, in New Orleans. What? Yeah.
Exactly. It's a New Orleans show. She's like the, Trixie's like the classy burlesque dancer, just stunning on stage and beautiful and does the fan dance and wears the bling and the jewelry. Mm-hmm. But at the same time just has unbelievable comedic timing that just is something you can't teach, that just comes naturally. And I'm sure she has benefited from being involved with me and working with me and learned a lot, but she's never had the desire to do magic, as opposed to Kitty Chaos, who is a completely different character, who, as we already described, just bounces around bounces around like a little 4-year-old on stage, like just excited, but can absorb everything and really would love to just perform magic and has a love for the art, you know.
There was a young lady I've known for a long number of years, since, gosh, in the early 80s, went by Paula Panda and then changed her stage name to Paula Paul. And she was working a lot of gentlemen's clubs doing magic. She was trying to find basically any place.
I like Paula Panda. Why did she change it?
Well, she still used Paula Panda, I think, for some of those clubs. But I think she uses Paula Paul for casinos when she's working a different act. I mean, it's when she's leaving her clothes on, I think she works as Paula Paul.
Okay.
Paula, then P-A-U-L, you know.
That's a lot of Paul.
It's a lot of Paulas, yeah. But Paula Panda was the name that she had used, and I think still does in some clubs, but that she just performs, wants to, you know, find any place, you know, that has a venue. And that's kind of the last of the nightclub places, that in comedy clubs, you know, for anybody to do any sort of a, well, I'll start to say a vaudeville show, but I guess really, comedy clubs are really not a vaudeville show. It is what it is. It's a comedy club, you know, but there are some gentlemen clubs that are more than just, you know, pole dancing, you know, where they actually have entertainers, and that goes to the burlesque you were talking about, you know, in New Orleans, I guess. So, and sometimes in the burlesque shows that I have seen, they don't, you know, strip down and take it all off. I mean, it's more titillating, I guess, than anything, but
well,
they have
the
variety.
I prefer the tease. That's what it's about.
Yeah, exactly.
By the way, that's a panda photobomb. right there since you brought up pandas.
Oh, that's funny.
I was being body painted. And
be sure to send that so I can post that on the blog. Yeah, there too. Okay. So,
yeah, because they can't see it. You can only enjoy this right now.
Well,
they have to go to the blog and see the picture.
I don't know if enjoy is a word.
Which is one of those unusual things that you don't expect. You know, you're being body painted as a superhero, and all of a sudden, a girl who's painted as
like
a panda
comes and photobombs you. Yeah.
So that wasn't Paula Panda, but that was a panda.
Okay, funny.
I'm sorry. What was your question?
Well, speaking about that and master doing an MC, that you also do body painting.
Yes. So
tell me something. You mentioned that in the show, or in the lecture a little bit earlier, that, well, that's interesting too. Who is that?
That's who I was being painted as. That's the superhero Gambit.
Oh, okay.
So if you're not familiar with Gambit from the X-Men, that's who I aspire to be because
they filmed the, part of the X-Men in New Orleans, didn't they?
Well, which one?
Well, they talked about, because the guy who was Gambit, I thought was supposed to be in the French Quarter playing poker or something, wasn't
he? Well, the Wolverine movie had Gambit in it, and they made some scenes that looked like New Orleans, but it wasn't filmed in New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to a lot of things that have been filmed there, because, you know, now we're like Hollywood South.
Right, exactly.
But that was actually scenes that were set up to look like New Orleans, and they introduced Gambit. Now, the guy who, that's my favorite character, and I would love to play him. I've, like, actually written a screenplay that I have to, you know, finish after 12 years of playing around with, about Gambit's life.
Yeah, the guy who starred in that was also in the television show Friday Night Lights.
Exactly. He was the one that played Gambit, and I think he did a good job.
Sure
the problem
did.
Was that Gambit had nothing to do with Wolverine's story. They just basically crowbarred this character in, which often these movies do, that just because they want to introduce a cool character. So it's like they use this introduction just to like, hey, we introduced this cool guy that you guys want to see. And now what they're talking about is the next time they use Gambit, they're going to have Channing Tatum play Gambit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you're aware of why.
Of Magic Mike?
Of why that just like really boils my skull beyond belief, because not only has he taken my stage name that I've had since I was 13, it was given to me. It wasn't like I chose the name Magic Mike, but he, you know, made a movie about strippers named Magic Mike, and now he not only takes my stage name, but my fantasy character as well, so he's gonna play Gambit, and meanwhile I'm like, hello, I'm the real Magic Mike, and I've been talking about playing Gambit for years, because Gambit is from New Orleans, he has a Cajun accent, he's a member of the Thieves Guild, throws cards, that's his power is he can charge up objects and they explode, so he throws cards, it's like unlimited grenades, and that's who Gambit is. And so he's like one of the coolest X-Men that there is that hasn't been introduced in the X-Men movies, but he was introduced in the Wolverine movie.
Okay.
So apparently Channing Tatum, Magic Mike, is going to play Gambit at some point. And so I've just been, as much as I make jokes about it, I know that there's somehow some type of anti-Channing Tatum publicity that I'm going to gain out of this, I'm sure, because those that know me know that I love that character.
Yeah.
So I not only played that character on stage for the burlesque show, because we had the theme of superheroes one month, with Trixie's burlesque show, the Florida Tees. So I played Gambit, and then just recently in Florida at the
Florida State Convention.
It's the International Convention of Body Painting. It's called FABIAC, however you want to pronounce the acronym, but it's the Face and Body Art International Convention. And Jay Bautista, who's an amazing body painter from Orlando, painted me as Gambit. So that's the picture you were just looking at.
Yeah, okay.
Where it looks like I walked out of a comic book.
Yes.
Because that's what... That's
it looked like it actually stuck your face on something. You know what I mean? Like you stuck...
No, that's
poked
me.
Your face through
totally body painted. The abs are painted. That's airbrushed abs.
Uh-huh.
So actually the lesson is that if you have the money, you should hire a full-time body painter as opposed to working out. Because as you can see, I look buff.
You do.
Absolutely.
I think even I could look good.
And the tagline is hashtag screw Channing Tatum, because I look like a good Gambit, right?
You know? You do.
Yeah.
You do. And so you have been doing the MC work for these body painting. Are they contests, or are they just come on and you just
No, there is a contest at the end. It's
like
4 days.
Okay.
Well, picture it's like a magic convention, except way sexier.
Mm-hmm.
Way sexier because, first of all, there's women.
Yeah.
So
it's not like a magic convention at all.
More than 2.5. Yeah, there's it's not like it at all. There's basically 3 days of workshops, mm-hmm. and where instructors are brought in and they teach different techniques, because there's, you know, both regular brush and airbrush and all these different you know, genres that you can paint. There's even like rooms that are designated to blacklight effects and 3D effects and all this crazy stuff, and you see just the most unbelievable art. And your first time going, yeah, you notice the fact that half the people are running around half naked.
Mm-hmm.
But then once you really are absorbed into the world, you kind of forget that fact, because the fact they're not half naked, they're all covered in paint.
Correct.
And which looks sometimes like clothing, or looks like characters, or looks like
sure.
a fantasy world. And it's amazing what these people can do and put together in the amount of time. And so at the last day, they have, well, they have a face contest of just face art, and then there's a body painting contest as well. And there's a different theme each year. And I want to say that it's probably about 100 competitors in the body contest. And it's
all over the world, or just the U.S.? Or
well, this is international. Yeah, this one in Florida has been going on for over 12 years now, and it's international.
And what do you do as the MC? I mean, do you say, okay, give me applause for this one or something? Or are you kind of like the...
That's it. That's all I do.
Oh,
that's,
really?
Yeah, you could, now you could take my job. That's... I said,
That's
give
it.
Me applause. Yeah, no, I, well, there's a lot of events. So, I emcee a lot of different, like, we did a game show this year. Mm-hmm. We did, like, Family Feud, but it was...
So you're not doing any magic or anything. It's basically just get them on, get them off.
Sometimes, no, I do some magic, but, for the competition itself, I usually don't, because mm-hmm. that's a situation where, yeah, you want to feature the art. It's not about, you know, featuring what you do as an artist. It's about them. And so, I tried to use other skills I've acquired, like comedy and improv and acting skills. And, 1 year I did, there was certain breaks set up so that I could do a little routine, in between things.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a couple, actually I did, a really crazy routine where it combined, I don't know what it's called, the old, it's the mask and costume where you have three kids, and you're going to know what I'm talking about. I don't know what it's called though, where like, you can do it with a nursery rhyme where there's a witch, and you basically you do a switch.
Oh, where the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe kind of thing.
Well, there's a switch where the kids are costumed, so you don't know that kid one is really kid three. You follow what I'm saying?
No.
Where the mask... Okay, we'll look it up. It's in Mark Wilson's book, I think.
Oh.
Like, originally, like...
You're talking about the trick that... okay, well, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe were, you know, go way back, you know.
That, something like that effect where, you know,
like Leroy,
but
Tom
I did it with face paint.
Mm-hmm.
So we had three different people choose three different things, and one of them ends up being forced so that the kid three ends up being kid one, and it looks like three separate free choices of one was a superhero, one was a wild animal, one was a color.
Okay.
And so we had a, what was your color? Purple Mardi Gras mask. What was your animal? Tiger. What was your superhero? Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pull the bags off the kids' heads, and they've been face painted as
those three. Oh, to look just like each of those three.
Selections, yeah.
Cool, okay.
It was, yeah, it was crazy, and mm-hmm. Totally blew everybody away. And it was combined sure. in face painting with a basic magic principle,
mm-hmm.
You know, combining a couple of different effects to make it really an interesting and very unique.
Very cool.
Yeah. Routine for these people to see, yeah.
And very customized for that particular type
definitely
of thing.
Definitely.
And that's what I'm always telling people, you know, that when you're going to be a master of ceremonies, or you're going to be working for a company, particularly at a trade show, but even if you're going to be doing something that's a corporate engagement for a holiday party or employee meeting, as long as you do at least one thing that has something to do with something's relatable that the company understands. If you say an inside joke or mention someone's name or a product or something, then they kind of get it, you know, or do a trick that uses that, you know, then I think that they will remember you more than anybody else. That's a good way of trying to establish your USP, your unique selling proposition, because that differentiates you from somebody else.
Absolutely.
You know,
even it could be as simple as just knowing what sports team is everybody rooting for right now. And just having that information and knowing that makes a world of difference, because they feel like, okay, this guy, he knows us, he wants to be part of us. I'll give you an example. I went to see a magic show at Harrah's in New Orleans, and thank you. And
we're having joining some scotch right now, by the way, then. with Len Marenghi.
And this is how Scott conducts all his interviews.
Yes, it is.
So I won't say the guy's name simply because I don't even remember it, but it was an Illusion show. But he opens by appearing, and then he comes out on stage, and he says, "Hello, New Orleans."
Ooh.
And you hear crickets.
Of course.
Because he obviously didn't do enough research to know that nobody local says New Orleans. Uh-huh. We all say New Orleans. Uh-huh. We don't say Nolens.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks it's Nolens. The only tourists say Nolens. A good way to get robbed is to say Nolens, and that's how you'll get mugged, because they'll know you're a tourist. Wear some Mardi Gras beads and say Nolens and walk down the street, and somebody's going to take your wallet.
Yeah.
And New Orleans is the only time you say New Orleans is if you have to rhyme it in a song.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's just New Orleans. That's how any of the locals will pronounce it.
It's like Louisville, you know, that Louisville, Kentucky, or some might say Louisville or Louisville, or, you know, different ways of pronouncing that, you know. But I think that people from Louisville like to have it pronounced Louisville.
Right.
You know, but New Orleans is kind of what I've always said.
Well, and it doesn't really matter because people say it different ways, but when you're on stage and you're in front of a local crowd
and you're trying to endear
you say New Orleans
because
you're trying to be part of these people, you've immediately ostracized yourself. You've immediately
alienated.
Proven that I'm not one of you. Now I have to overcome that obstacle to get you to like me,
mm-hmm.
and just
you created a taller wall.
And maybe maybe he didn't know and no one told him, but just a simple little bit of, you know, Google research and figuring, you know, trying to figure out where am I going, what's their favorite sports team, you know, because that kind of thing could come up.
Sure.
And you should know, because if you're going to improv at all with an audience member or interact with spectators, then that can happen.
Now, you do a lot of improv, and you say that you teach a class, high schoolers, I guess,
yes.
on improvisation. And you're going to be going to Edinburgh, Scotland with this group?
Well, knock on, you have some wood?
Yeah.
Well, because I hope that that's the plan anyways.
Yeah.
So Jesuit High School in New Orleans actually got accepted to what's the oldest fringe festival in the world in Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of schools applied to be a part of this festival, and their theater program is just incredible. I can't describe what they've put into this theater and the... it's not an orchestra pit. It's an orchestra loft where, like, people didn't even know the last play that they did, which was Damn Yankees, that the music was all live coming from the orchestra. With students playing, like, just as many students playing music as were on stage as actors. So they submit and get accepted to this festival, and they can bring, like, 60 students. And so the teacher, the theater director who actually hired me to be the improv coach... was already considering me as a chaperone, but when I brought it up, I was like, I should be a chaperone. She said, well, I was actually considering that you, because all my improv students are members of the theater program.
Mm-hmm. She's like an after-school program or something?
It is an after-school program.
Okay.
And she's like, I would like you to be in Scotland and actually have the troupe perform in the street and do like street improv to drum up attention to bring people as audience members to watch our performance.
Yeah.
And I mean, that just seems like a dream. And it actually falls right after FISM in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be great to go straight from there to Scotland. And the whole thing started because the students came up with it. The students said, you know what? We don't have an improv. We don't have an improv team at this high school. And she said, well, that's because nobody has an improv team at their high school. And they said, well, we should have one. She said, that is a great idea, but I don't have time for that. So let me think. Who do I know who is be free on a Tuesday afternoon because they've never had a real job? Magic Mike. So she calls me, knowing I'm a magician, and we go way back. She's her sister, who's been my manager, who was married to a magician, who's known me for years.
Yeah.
So the whole family has known me, and she said, would you be interested? She knew I was doing improv comedy.
That goes
well.
Back to something. I just talked to someone recently who out in Hollywood who is a producer, and he was saying that people come out here and they're trying to make it, you know, but he said it has a lot to do with timing. But he said to be prepared. So when that instant comes, you know, when the opportunity presents itself, that not only do you say yes, but you can actually deliver the goods.
Right.
And so you have been in that position and just kind of happened to, you know, have that relationship. And so when she called, you're just like, yep, I can do it.
Let's, exactly.
Yeah.
Because I had been pursuing ever since after Hurricane Katrina, actually. I started working with a few comedians, including Kitty Chaos, on improv comedy.
Yeah.
And learning all the basics to improv, which is amazing. And I've been flabbergasted at how many magicians don't even know the two words that make up the basic rules of improv. Because the first rule is two simple words, yes and. And I actually didn't get a chance to get into that in the lecture. I usually explain that.
Okay.
In my lecture.
Tell us.
So the first rule of improv, because it's all about responding and making your partner look good. So yes and. So for example, let's say we're in a scene together. We're okay. Partners. And
yes, and then what do we do?
The audience says, yes and. The audience says, the suggestion from the audience is we're on a beach.
Okay.
So that's all you and I know. And I say, look, there's a boat. And you go,
yes,
that's
and
not
there
a boat.
Was...
Well, no, wait, well, let's do it the bad way. So the worst way to do is you go, that's not a boat. So now we're not even on the same page. So like we haven't started the scene because we don't know what's going on. The audience doesn't know what's going on. We've wasted time.
I see.
Because now we have to.
We're arguing with each other. We're not
arguing.
Agreeing with,
we have to solve this argument before we can even start the scene.
Sure.
So nothing's created. They can't visualize anything. So let's change the scenario where you agree with me. I say, look, there's a boat. And you go, that is a boat. Well, that's great. You've agreed with me.
Yes.
But nothing. You said yes, but you didn't provide any and. So nothing has been established other than we're on the same page. There's a boat.
Yes, there's a boat. And there's somebody who just fell in the water.
Now we have a scene.
Yeah.
You said yes, and now I hear the last thing you said, and I respond to that. Well, maybe we should save him. And then we go from that. Well, how are we going to save him?
We're going to save him for.
And so now the audience can visualize everything we're
yes,
seeing because
right.
We're on the same page and we're visualizing. They see the boat. They see the person overboard. They see the life raft. They see whatever it is that we create.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have a scene. We have something to work with because we're yes-anding each other. It's like a reverse Jenga where you're building upon each person providing something so the other person can build
right,
upon it.
Right.
So that's what the basic rules, the two words yes and.
That's the first rule. You said there's a second rule?
There's a lot of basic rules. Once you get better and better, you can kind of bend or break the rules. Like you don't have to actually say the words yes and, but when we're practicing, we say that just
okay.
to get in the mindset of like train them because it's hard to say yes and no but. But it's easy to no but if you're not saying the words yes and.
But still creating the scene and kind of agreeing with him by saying no but. So if you say there's a boat, no, that's a yacht.
Right.
Know.
So like if, for instance, if our characters, if it made sense for me to disagree with you as my character.
Yes.
That would be fine because I'm still yes anding you. But as my, like let's say you're a dad and I'm a
child.
Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you say you have to come in at 10 o'clock tonight. And I go, no, I want to come in at 11. Well, I'm disagreeing with you as the character.
I see what you're saying.
But I'm still agreeing with your premise, and I'm yes-anding you because I'm going with your premise, and I'm giving, I'm saying, no, I want to come in at 11. So I'm giving you something to work with, but our characters are disagreeing as partners, as players, we're not disagreeing.
Gotcha.
But what amazed me is that in my lectures, I asked that question. I didn't get to it tonight, and we talked about it a lot, so I'm surprised
we did.
But I usually ask the question to everyone. What are the two words that make up the first rule of improv? And only twice so far in how many lectures I've done over the last... I mean, not that many because I'm new to the game, but...
done about, I'm going to say...
At least
15, 20?
Yeah. And only about two people have actually said the word, have actually been able to raise their hand
really?
And tell me those
I would
words.
Not have been able to say yes hand.
Well, and most... Because most magicians... They learn magic. They learn the mechanics. They focus on the
well.
You know, the
for the most part, when magicians are working, it's us. We're not working with a partner.
That's true too.
You know, if you are working,
but you are because anytime you involve the audience, a spectator, that's not planned. It's not scripted. The minute you involve somebody that doesn't have lines, that's no longer scripted.
It's
that's an
improv
situation. It's
okay.
Totally improv, and you are. If you're working, if you're experienced, you're directing that conversation. They're responding and behaving as you want them to. That as they come up onto the stage and as they continue, you start learning different techniques to get them to basically yes and you the entire time because that's what you need to happen for the routine to... Well, you just don't even realize you're doing it.
That's true. As you are directing them to take a card or to draw a picture or to think of something or whatever
sure.
it is, that they are doing what you're telling them to do. I mean, they are following your direction, but they are not, I don't see a yes and that they are coming back and telling you. I don't.
Well, here's an example of how we use that knowledge in magic,
okay.
Like, or that technique. So let's say I'm doing like the cigarette vanish.
Okay.
And this has happened before where, and then somebody goes, some know-it-all who bought a Chris Angel kit from Walgreens, knows about a thumb tip.
Sure.
And he's going to go, hey, I know what you did. I saw what you did. Most often the response is to negate the heckler and make him look silly, or this is what comedians do. They live for those moments when they can show how witty they are and how dumb the heckler is, and you know, make them look like a fool. Well, as magicians, that's the worst thing we can do, because when you heckle a comedian, you're not showing anything. You're not divulging. You're not divulging anything. You're just maybe, you know, stepping on their timing. But, you know, as magicians, you don't want to create enemies in the crowd that can divulge what you're doing.
Turn it against you.
So what if we apply that same technique of yes and? So the guy goes, I saw what you did. You have something on your thumb. I know that trick. And I, instead of saying, no, you don't. Get this guy out of here. Who let the drunk in? What is he doing here? Hey, why don't you shut up, dude? I'm working here. Like, instead of handling it that way, I say, yeah, you know what? This guy's sharp. I saw you were watching me. I knew he knew what he was talking about. You probably saw the magnet in my shoe. So all of a sudden, I said yes. I agree with you. And
you're diverting attention.
And as a magician, I provided confusing information as the and. So I said, yes, you're smart. You're a sharp guy. You know what you're talking about. And you probably know about the magnet in my shoe. And now what does he do? He goes, because he's on the spot.
Sure.
So, like, if he says he doesn't know about the magnet, then he outs himself as not really knowing anything, because I'm the magician, I'm the expert, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he loses all credibility with the crowd because he doesn't know about the magnet. But yet, he's probably going to just agree with me. He basically wants to just let me take over and just stop the conversation, because he's just going to make himself look foolish because he doesn't know what I'm talking about. And so he's just going to agree with me anyway and like, oh yeah, I saw you. Well, you did something.
And now he's
confused because he doesn't know if he, did I see a thumb tip or does he have a magnet? What the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
So sometimes by just providing confusing information, like for example, someone goes, How do you do that rubber band thing? I'll do like Chinese handcuffs. And I say, oh, well, don't tell anybody.
But crazy man handcuffs.
I have an crazy man handcuffs. I have an anti-gravity ring.
Yeah.
So it creates the illusion of skill, and I start doing ring stuff.
Manipulate your finger ring.
And so my answer to how to crazy man's handcuffs works is I have an anti-gravity ring, which doesn't help him at all. In fact, just confuses him worse. But I didn't say no. I didn't say I won't tell you. I said we can be friends. Don't tell anybody. This is just between us. It's a secret. But I just confused them even more.
That's a different perspective, certainly. Speaking of the ring, as you were just showing me that, I would like for you to kind of come back full circle. I mentioned earlier about Sylvester Stallone, and you have been doing some things and also in the movies, and I thought that was kind of a funny story. Now, you've been going around and lecturing, but it probably wasn't until this lecture that something came up that you told that story, so others would like to hear that as well.
So I think the question was about how much time I had put into it.
Into manipulating
and
your finger
ring. And
I talked
about when I got good at it.
Yeah. It only took you, what, 10,000 hours?
10,000 hours would mean I was a master.
Yeah.
It hasn't been that much because
so you're not a master?
I'm going to have to look up to see exactly when it was. But I want to say probably within 5-6 years that I've been working on that. And the reason was because I had seen it done. The basically, what do you call it? The I don't know what this is called.
It's like
exactly.
A coin roll, but basically at the fingertips.
I call it my anti-gravity ring. It's like a coin roll at the fingertips.
Yeah.
Steve Martin did it in Father of the Bride.
He personally did it, or was there a hand?
No, I'm pretty sure it was him. Well, Steve Martin was a magician.
I know he was, but I didn't know how much slide
well,
hand
I think
he
would
did.
Probably feel guilty if he had it.
Yeah,
I mean, really, you know, if any magician is booked on it, you know, and they have a hand. I know a lot that would go for it. They're mostly illusionists, but oh, did I say that?
Vegas.
It was also in a James Bond movie years ago.
You mentioned that, you know, and that
I think Golden, either, well, it was Golden something, Golden Eye,
Golden Gun.
I think it was the man with the golden gun.
It may have been with Mantha Golden Gun, perhaps, but that was...
He's doing the ring thing, isn't it?
Yeah. That was Roger Moore, though. That wasn't Sean Connery.
No, no, no. I didn't mean James Bond was doing it. Somebody was doing it.
I know maybe that, but I thought you were talking about it was a Sean Connery. You
oh, was it Roger Moore?
It was Roger Moore who was Mantha Golden Gun, though.
I stand corrected then. Okay. Roger Moore. It was but in other words, it was back in the day.
Yeah. No, I know my Bond because I named my son Sean after Sean Connery after it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Before I got into Magic, I was a huge... It's a whole other subject. But so anyhow, so you got in the movie. So
okay.
That,
so
you were I doing the call. You knew you've been fiddling around and doing that for fun.
I've been
fun.
Fiddling around with it because I saw it, but I didn't really know it. But then I get a call from somebody in the film industry who says, I know you do sleight of hand. Do you do sleight of hand with rings? And I said, sure. He could have said, do you do sleight of hand with squirrels? And I would have... I'd have said, yeah, absolutely, all the time, because I wanted the gig.
That reminds me, you know, also then of Doug Henning, whenever that he got the call from, I think it was Mobile back then, and they were going to be doing a television special based on Magic and said, can you do Houdini's Water Torture Escape? And he said, yes. And they said, great, you're going to be on this, we're going to have a one-hour special and focus the magic of Doug Henning. The very next phone call, he called Johnny Gaughan. He said, how do I do this? I have no idea.
Nice.
Yeah.
Which we should circle back to that because I'm about to do a Houdini Water Torture.
No, okay.
Yeah.
So.
My competition act.
So they called you and you said, yes, I can do this.
I said, yes, I can do this. And they said, the next question was, do your hands look Asian? I'm like, do my hands look Asian? I said, I actually said, I can squint while I'm doing it. That helps you out at all. And he says, well, I guess we could spray your hands to look like Jets. And I was like, wait a minute. Are you talking about Jet Li? And he said, yeah, we need somebody to be a hand double, do a ring thing to look like Jet Li's hands.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? Knowing how Hollywood works, I knew it might not work out. I said, even if this doesn't work out, it's just good to know that I can do something that Jet Li can't. Because I'm sure he's better at sleight of foot, but now I can do sleight of hand.
Yeah.
So they bring me to the set, and the whole time they were talking about... it was filmed in New Orleans, and they're talking about, we need you to meet the director. And they kept calling him Sly. That was his nickname, Sly.
Sure.
So they bring me over, and then Sylvester Stallone walks out of the trailer and goes, oh, hey, you the magician. Go on in. Sit down. And next thing I know, I'm sitting there in his trailer with Sylvester Stallone for 30 minutes, showing him ring stuff, you know, ring tricks. And he's like taking the ring with his sausage fingers going, oh, you could do like, oh, look, it's gone. Oh, you know, you don't have to do it fast. I can slow down the film. I just slow it down. Like, oh, yeah, really? That's how it works? Wow, good to know. Thank you for being so informative about how film works, Mr. Stallone. Like, so he gave me his ring to practice with, which was, like, weighed a pound. And it wasn't like this banded ring that I use. It was like, I challenged Garrett Thomas to work with this thing. As brilliant as he is with the rings.
Yeah.
It was like a skull and crossbones, this huge thing with jewels in it.
Yeah.
And I had to actually train differently.
I assume that you've worked, by the way, as an aside, with other Super Bowl rings, and those things are heavy, as you know.
You know what's funny is my wife has actually she has a picture where she's has a Super Bowl ring on.
Yeah.
She actually got to... I've never even seen one.
You haven't?
No.
I've used them a couple times, and those things are huge, and they're
really
heavy. Oh, yeah.
I'm sure they're heavy.
One time
you know the Saints won the Super Bowl, right?
Who are they? The Saints?
New Orleans Saints.
Oh, sorry. I guess I shouldn't say anything. We got the Houston Texans, who really suck. I actually did one time with... They give the Super Bowl ring also to the referees. You know, I did a ref's ring, which was... You know, quite unique also. It's big. So, his ring was a skull and crossbones, kind of like a Hell's Angels, kind of a big-ass ring.
Yes. I practiced for 4 days straight to be able to do some effects with the ring so I could pretend to be Jet Li. In the back of
it was supposed to be Jet's hand again, not Jet's, Sly's.
Okay. Yeah, right. He's supposed to snag the ring from Sly. We're calling him Sly. Like we know him. Like,
yeah, we're all buds.
Sly. And, let's go punch some meat. And, And I grabbed the ring and then would do the trick. And they brought me out there, I think, two or three different nights that I was on set waiting to film the scene, knowing we're never going to get to this tiny little ring scene because they were too busy blowing stuff up. I mean, you could feel the heat. They're exploding everything and going around.
You were on set all day long?
I was on set, well, the whole night. Everything, it was all at night, and there's guys with machine guns and they're blowing up this Jeep and they're blowing up this tank and they're blowing up this ice cream
stand. This for the Replacements movie.
No, that was the football movie. No, the Expendables.
Expendables, sorry. Yeah. Right.
No, that was actually a funny movie, Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, that's right.
The Expendables, horrible movie, but go watch it. Action-packed. They explode stuff. I just ruined the plot. There you go. That's the story. Stuff blows up. And they were so busy blowing stuff up, they never had time to actually film the scene. So don't bother watching the DVD for the scene or the behind the scenes because we never shot it. But I got to meet Sylvester Stallone and, you know, sit in his trailer and show him.
What did they say
stuff
at the end as far as, we don't have time to shoot it and sorry, and here's your money, I mean, you're off, and they... I mean, did they say come back later or they're just...
No, like they really wanted to shoot it, but it was actually... an addition to the script that Sylvester Stallone came up with. It wasn't in the script originally, and
it was his idea. He wanted to do it.
Yeah, he wanted to
shoot this.
He
was the director, so I was the director, not the writer. Yeah.
So it would have been cool, but I had to leave town, and then they had to leave town, and I thought they would find somebody in California to do it, but they ended up not shooting it, which was sad because it was a cool idea.
Yeah.
But
so you're saying that he gave you the ring to fiddle with for 4 days.
For 4 days, and it was his only one. So when I got a call from like one of the ADs that says, "Can you please bring Sylvester Stallone's Can you please bring Sylvester Stallone's ring back to set because it's the only one, and for continuity's sake, he's got to be wearing it in every scene. Because if they didn't close up, he wouldn't have the ring." And so I didn't have my car for some reason. I'm texting my friends, going, "I'll explain later. But I need to bring Sylvester Stallone's ring back to Harahan. Can you please give me a ride?" And I got it over there somehow and gave him the ring back so he could, you know, wear it for the scenes. And they blew some more stuff up.
Yeah.
And they exploded some more things.
Just for you.
Yep. And then nobody got hurt. They took a lot of precautions, which I think
that's what took the time. Well,
yeah, that was time consuming. They would quit worrying about everybody and just blow the stuff up, like stay back. But no, they have to take all kind of safety precautions so nobody gets killed. Because it's real fire, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they do some CGI, but they really blew stuff up.
Uh-huh.
Like totally. It was fun. It was fun watching the explosions.
Well, I guess it was.
Like being on a war zone.
Probably more fun being in the movie than it was actually watching the movie.
Yeah, the movie was horrible. Yeah. But no, it's okay to say
so
that.
So horrible that they actually made a sequel.
They made a sequel, and the sequel's horrible, and you should watch them both. And because, well, I mean, I ruined it. You know they blow stuff up, but that's the plot of both of them. And the thing is, though, if you say a movie's mediocre, then nobody will go see it. But if you say it's horrible, then they have to see it because they have to see why it's so bad. So it's almost better that I say that. It's either great and you got to see it, or it's horrible and you got to see it to see why it's so horrible. So it's good publicity for both movies because I'm saying these are horrible movies, action-packed. You should see them. So you can sit with your friends, have a drink, and make fun of them and talk about, you know, this, all these action heroes.
Sure.
Sylvester Stallone and any other action hero you can think of is in this movie.
Some years ago, they had the IBM convention in Boston.
Except for Channing Tatum. He didn't make it in.
I cut his part, which you liked, I'm sure. So it was IBM convention, and half the group went to see Le Grand David show, and the other half got to see Dr. Magic. And the Dr. Magic show apparently was an absolutely horrible show, and it was so bad that everybody talked about that the next day, saying, "You got to see that show. It's so bad. There's nothing, you know, worse. It'll be the most memorable thing." It was so bad they actually fired the guys, I guess, and they didn't even do the show. They had a completely different show the second night. So it was like a one only kind of a show that they ended up putting on, and it was But the point was that everyone was anxious now to go see a horrible show, you know, because they've been told how bad that it actually is. Along that line, one of the things that you mentioned during the lecture tonight was where that you had seen a performance or a lecture. No, it was a lecture, and someone had taught something. And the point being is that we can always learn something, even if it's from a poor performance or a poor performer or a poor lecturer or something. There's a silver lining in everything, basically.
Right. Well, because I remember my thoughts leaving that lecture was that I got nothing out of it. That was a waste of time, waste of an afternoon, that none of those routines were anything I would use. But there was one little part that I had stored in my memory and for years was obviously in my head. I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere too.
Right.
but because I try to always take notes. But it was that was the only thing I remember, but I never used it. And it wasn't until I saw Danny D'Ortiz's lecture, which is that's one that you should take 1,000 notes because his stuff is brilliant.
Right.
That is not a waste of time. Even if you don't do cards, you need to apply these ideas. And all of a sudden it clicked for me. And this one little bit that I had taken is now a staple in my lecture because I combine it with an idea that Danny D'Ortiz teaches about. And so like a lecture that to me was a waste of an afternoon has now for the last year and a half become a staple routine. So,
right.
You know, as long, if you take one, like the first trick I ever did for a restaurant manager to get booked at TGI Fridays was the blank business card. Sure. Doing the paddle move. Mm-hmm. And if so, like that trick won me that gig, which built to everything I've done since then, the exposure that I've gotten to other restaurants and starting with birthdays and then moving on from there. So if I had paid $1,000 to learn that one paddle move to show a blank business card on both sides,
right?
If I had to really pay $1,000 in the long run, it was worth it.
Yeah.
It would have totally been worth it because of what it has achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So you never know, like when you're going to get just one little gem that is you're going to take with you. So anytime you can, you know, put in the effort to learn from someone, even if they're bad, you're going to learn from them. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. You're going to learn about what you don't want to do. You're going to learn about how you want to restructure your act. Like if this guy is really bad, why is he bad? Why do I not like it? Why is he making me cringe?
Yeah.
Why does that guy make me want to not be a magician? Is it because of the stance he's using? Is it because he's wearing blue jeans on stage? Is it because he's wearing sequins? Is it because he has a mask on? Like, why is he?
Right,
what
right.
is it that he's doing that's making me want to quit what I do? Like, you know, and learn from that. And, you know, maybe you don't have to make a kibidachi horse dance every time you wave your arms to make a girl jump out of a box.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't have to dress that way. Maybe you don't have to address the crowd and say, New Orleans. Like, you can learn from and realize what it is that, what can make my act better, you know? And so there's always little gems in there. You just have to be willing to go and catch them.
Right.
And figure out how to use them to your advantage.
Right. I think it's a good takeaway that you have to approach everything as a learning opportunity, whether it's going to be good, bad, or indifferent, but go into it with, you know, a positive attitude that I'm going to enjoy this, or if not, that I'm going to come away with something positive. Maybe even if it's, I'm not going to do it this way, you know, I've learned that's not, you know, the right way to do it. Or you might be thinking that it is a presentation that you might want to use, but that doesn't fit your style. I say, you know, you don't want to copy their presentation, but maybe that there might be something that you see that's going to be, again, good that you might want to take a piece here or there. And I think that's where a person's personality comes in. That's how you get molded, is to take perhaps a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and that is part of the creativity process, that the more that you can do, the more of your creative muscle that you're exercising in trying to write something, to develop something, to invent a new routine. And again, there's really nothing new under the sun particularly. It's just a matter of taking those ideas and creating something new with that. I mean, it could be a double lift and then a false shuffle and you've got a new trick. But if you do a false shuffle and then a double lift, that's a different trick, you know.
Right.
It is a. There was a lecture I heard once by Guy Hollingworth at the Magic Circle centenary a few years ago, and he was talking about, as an engineer, which he is trained, I think he's a barrister, but he was talking about engineering this, I think it was a coffee maker or maybe a tea maker or something, where that water would come in from one filter, come in one side filter and then come out the other way as tea or whatever, you know, and so it could be, you know, lined up on its side, or you can put them on top of each other, or reverse them, or perhaps, I mean, there are only so many ways you could do that, you would think, but the more you think about things of re-engineering something, just like you were talking about this evening of taking a invisible deck and looking at it as a mismade deck, you know, I, for a number of years, and in my lecture, talk about, well, rather than trying to worry about adding these up, you know, of having the spades and the hearts and the diamonds and the clubs, you know, match to add up to 13, of having just the exact thing on the opposite side, so that you have the red, you know, the ace of diamonds opposite of the ace of hearts. So it's red to red, you know, and the exact number, you know, to the other. It's just a little tip, and it's something, you know, like Forrest Gump would say, well, that's one less thing I have to worry about.
Right, exactly.
You know, and if it's, and I've never had anybody who is, question that and say, right. Wait a minute, that's next to that other eight or whatever, you know.
No, not at all.
And the kind of thing that you've got, I hadn't thought of as far as, you know, spreading them and looking like a mismade deck. I've seen that before where you're looking at the back, you know, it's like an the brainwave deck, you know, where you're looking at the backs of them and yeah. Turn one over. But clever ideas, you know, I thought you had a lot of really great stuff. And so many of you guys have already seen Michael's lecture, but there are a lot more who have not seen his lecture out there or who are overseas in other countries. And if you guys are thinking about someone who is wanting to, if you're wanting to hire a lecturer, I mean, he is an award-winning magician
right.
with a lot of things. And I assume that was one of the reasons that you had entered these contests in order to kind of make your name kind of known. But it's not just that you are a creative guy, but you can also explain it. And I think in an entertaining way also, so that people were able to not only be entertained but to understand, so that there are few questions left to ask because of the thoroughness of it, and furthermore that includes things that are, like I just mentioned, you know, an invisible deck that may be fairly easy to something that's more difficult, like the coin roll with your ring and things like that. So there are things for different people at different levels, from beginner to professional, and whatever that you're really wanting, and plus some other great, you know, things in your package. So I'm not necessarily here to try to promote and push. Well, yes, I am. I think you should have Michael, you know, consider him for a lecture. But aside from that, just a great guy. And I thank you very much for being on the podcast today. You had a lot of really great ideas. I know I've asked you this in the past, and I don't remember what you had said. The answer was to the magic word. That is, what your magic word is. Do you remember?
Oh, right, because that was the podcast that is in space somewhere.
That's right.
That got deleted somehow. My word was relentless.
Ah, now I do remember that. Yes, right.
Yeah. Now, I've stolen that word from a friend of mine in sales who I knew for years, one of my best friends, who had that on his phone that he would look at every day. That was his word. And as a salesperson, and he's developed a company now, he's been incredibly successful, and his word was just relentless. Like, to go after whatever you want,
right.
Be relentless about it. And so when you first asked me that,
yeah,
that's the word that popped in my head of, like, lately, that's how I feel, that I have gone after what, you know, like you said earlier, you plan your work and you work your plan.
Right.
And you if you do that and you're relentless about it, then why would you expect anything other
that's
than
success.
The results you desired?
Right.
And that's, you know, most people don't do that. And when they want, why am I not having the success I want? They haven't done it.
That's right. They can look back. You know, you have need to have that, you know, 6 month, 1 year, 3, 5, 15 year plan. And if you don't have any plan, then, you know, then you have no one to blame but yourself. You shouldn't look back 10 years from now and say, gee, I wish I would have done such and such. Well, if you would have had a plan, you could have, you know. So you need to be relentless in, first of all, making a plan, and then relentless in pursuing that. Because what you'll find every time, is that you will achieve that goal in a lot less time than what your original plan was. If you want something, it's a 5-year goal, you'll find that if you're relentless, you can get that in 2 to 3 years or so. And then reset your sights. But make it reasonable. You know, don't say, you know, that I'm going to, you know, have my own Vegas show in a year, or, you know, something, or I'm going to be on television in 6 months or whatever. There are so many factors that come into play that I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'm saying that try to make it realistic, so that if something doesn't come about within a certain amount of time, that you're not going to be disappointed in yourself and give up on some of those dreams. So you need to work towards those and have those as achievable, realistic goals, and pursue that in a relentless way. I think that's an excellent word. I haven't had anybody say that except you in that lost podcast. So thank you, Michael, very much for being our guest today on the MagicWordPodcast.com. That was Michael Dardant. I guess I pronounced it correct. Not many people do say
Dardant. You have to, you're not supposed to pronounce the T.
The T?
Because it's French. Yeah.
Dardant.
There you go. Yeah.
Michael Dardon.
There you go.
And this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast. All right. This is Scotty out.
For more content, including pictures of my guest from this podcast, commentary, links, show notes, and more, be sure to visit the webpage at themagicwordpodcast.com. And you can help spread the word by liking the Magic Word Podcast on Facebook and sharing with your friends. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Till next time, Scotty out.